Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 15, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone will discuss copyright and copyright originalism, the question of whether today's copyright regime is in keeping with the founder's vision. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're happy to have with us today two experts on our topic. We'll hear first opening remarks from each of about 5 to 10 minutes, then a little back and forth, and then, as always, questions from our audience. The bios for each of our speakers have been provided to you in the notice of today's call, so I'm going to be extremely brief in my introductions, and we'll get right to the substance. We'll hear first from Professor Tom W. Bell. He's a professor of law at Chapman University School of Law. And then from Professor Christopher Newman. He's associate professor of law at the George Mason University School of Law. And with that, Professor Bell, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and welcome everybody to this discussion about copyright. I'm going to talk a little bit about how the founders handled copyright and propose that we learn from that and perhaps even return to some of the very limited remedies and really philosophy that they had behind copyright. And by way of showing that I'm putting my money where my mouth is, let me observe that my new book, Intellectual Privilege, Copyright, Common Law, and the Common Good, published this spring by the Mercatus Center, has been released under the 1790 Copyright Act, or should I say, we call it the Founder's Copyright. There's a front piece on the book, you can look at it yourself, where we say, hey public, we are only claiming the rights, the copyright rights in this book, that would have been allowed to us had we released this book under the 1790 Copyright Act. Well, why? Well, in part, it's simply because I really admire the founders. I think the founders had a very wise and limited approach to copyright, and I think we would do well to emulate that. It's also kind of an experiment. We want to see what happens, and I think it'll work out just fine, but no one knows for sure. I'd like to see more of these sort of historical reenactments of the law in areas much more important than copyright. I mean, I love copyright, but people don't live and die on copyright. I'd like to see us return to the founders' ideas in a lot of areas of law. This is just one small step. So what does it mean to release a work under the founders' copyright? Or more to the point, what did the 1790 Copyright Act provide, and why do I admire it so much? Well, let's note first the date. 1790. The people who ratified this were the same people who ratified the Constitution, in effect. This was one of the first acts of the first Congress. And of course, there was huge overlap between the people who drafted and ratified the Constitution and those who served in the first Congress. So I think this is a good way for us to figure out what the founders thought about copyright. What did they do about copyright? Almost immediately, 1790. And what did they do? They offered very limited rights and remedies. Let's start out with the coverage of the 1790 Copyright Act. I got a little lucky on this because it does cover books, but that's about all. It only covers maps, books, and charts. That's all the founders covered with the 1790 Copyright Act, and I think that's significant. Why? They were cultured men. They knew about paintings and music and poems and architecture, all those things and more protected by the current Copyright Act, and they chose not to protect them. Why? Because they did not have a natural rights view of copyright. Had they had a natural rights view, and appreciating as they did the arts, they would have immediately said, well, we have to protect painters as well, and they didn't. For them, copyright was a hard-nosed industrial policy. Maps, books, and charts. They didn't even list books first. They cared about the kinds of things that their fledgling nation needed to get up and running. It wasn't about protecting any kind of natural right. It was about offering a very limited statutory privilege to a certain select people just so they'd get off their rears and create the kinds of things that their new nation needed. So that's the scope of copyright. Books are covered, not much else. Maps, books, and charts. What about the term of copyright? Well, today the copyright term can run up to 120 years. For an individual author like myself, it's life of the author plus 70 years. What did the founders do in 1790? maximum term of 28 years. They actually divided it into two 14-year terms. You got a 14-year term, and then you had to renew if you wanted an additional 14 years. And if the author passed away in that first span, you were out of luck. That's it, 14 years maximum. Here's another thing to note. The founders passed a lean and mean Copyright Act, 1,308 words. Today's Copyright Act, and I'm not counting here the Copyright Office's regulations, which are voluminous, runs over 113,000 words. So that's two orders of magnitude of difference. If this were a visual medium, I'd show you the bar chart. It's astonishing how verbose current lawmakers have gotten. One more thing, and then I'll wrap it up and hand it over to Chris and your questions, which I'm looking forward to. The founders didn't do much for copyright holders. Now, here I do have to add a little bit to my book. There's not much by way of case law, but I've kept researching this. So this is a little bit of an update on what I had in my book, but here we go. The 1790 Copyright Act didn't do much for copyright holders. It did require them to jump through a lot of hoops, a lot of statutory formalities. It's not the way copyright works today. We can talk about that later. But if they did jump through all those hoops, what did they get? Well, basically, they got statutory damages of 50 cents per sheet, per infringing sheet of copyright. You know, if there was an infringing map, they'd get 50 cents per sheet of the map. And I've inflation-adjusted that for you. That's about $7 per copied sheet on an inflation-adjusted basis. Today, you can get $150,000 per infringed work. Many orders of magnitude difference. Also under the 1790 Copyright Act, as today, you could get bars on imports, destruction of infringing works, and if you filed a special action, you could get damages. That's something I'm updating from my book. Remedies under the current act go much farther than that. They include destruction of infringing copies and devices used in infringement, those statutory damages I mentioned of $150,000 in theory per infringed work, also actual damages, unjust profits, costs and attorney's fees, the power to subpoena digital service providers to disclose the identity of alleged infringers, and criminal sanctions. That's a big deal. Criminal sanctions including fines and imprisonment. So there we have it. The founders, whom I respect a lot, and I bet a lot of our listeners respect a lot, showed no evidence in the 1790 Copyright Act. They treated copyright like a natural right. They treated it like a very limited statutory privilege. And I think that's something that we should revisit, reconsider, and reenact today. We need to back off of this view that copyright represents a property right. There's some truth to that. Some of the best things about copyright are its property-like aspects. But I'm afraid my conservative friends have been bamboozled by this property talk. They're starting to treat copyright like they should treat property rights, intangibles, good old traditional natural common law property rights. Well, that's just not what copyright is. It doesn't deserve the same restrictions. The founders saw that, and we need to go back and learn from them. Thank you.
Professor Newman, your remarks?
Thanks. So I, too, like Tom, I'm a great admirer of the founders, and I would like to see us in many ways get to something closer to what they had in mind in our current copyright law. I mean, my main point of disagreement with Tom is this theme that he hit on a couple times that doesn't relate to any of the specific provisions that he discussed, but to the overall way in which we think about property right. There's this ongoing sort of rhetorical debate going on in policy forum, particularly on the conservative side, with regard to, at least right now it is, with regard to whether we should think of copyright as a form of property right, whether it has grounding in natural law or not, or whether we should view it, as Tom put it, as a form of hard-nosed industrial regulation. Now, I think this is actually a false dichotomy. And, you know, I would recommend actually to anybody who's really interested in the historiography of this and of the way that people have traditionally talked about copyright to read, there's an article by Justin Hughes called Of Copyright and Incomplete Historiography, which really gives you chapter and verse a lot of detail on this. But I think the bottom line is, if we're intellectually honest, copyright was talked about both as a form of monopoly in a certain sense and as a form of property in a certain sense. The fact is that copyright exists sort of in an in-between place. It was a monopoly in the sense that it was a exclusive right to engage in a class of activities that could not be defined by reference simply to interference with a particular tangible object. And as such, the power to grant that kind of right was abused, had been abused in England, and was very suspect for that reason. However, at the same time, the founding generation said very clearly that that was, as long as that right was used solely to grant rights to authors and inventors for their specific achievements, and as long as the right was limited in time, then that put it in a very different category. We still had to guard against abuse of the power, but it wasn't anymore a monopoly in the pejorative sense of the term. In fact, Madison said, even though he sometimes discussed it under the rubric of monopoly, he said it's one to which there is no just objection. So to the extent that we're talking about copyright in terms of saying we should be inherently skeptical simply because it's an exclusive right, I would disagree with that. And I would disagree with the idea that it's industrial regulation, pure and simple, if by that you mean we are required to jettison any idea that there's a valid moral claim underlying property right. I don't think the framers believed that. That was a dichotomy that for them didn't exist. And you can see that reflected in Federalist 43, where Madison says, this was something that was solemnly adjudged to be a right of authors at common law, and this is a place where the individual right and the public interest fully coincide. Now, I want to qualify that by saying that doesn't mean, I think there's equal overreaching on the other side. It is true that people have used the rhetoric of property and property rights in ways that are overreaching and have tried, for example, to expand the term of copyright excessively or to argue for the scope of copyright to be so broad that it uses, that it would include any sort of use of any of the material covered by a work. And that's overreaching. And I think to some extent there has been a backlash against that on the other side now trying to say that property talk is absolutely forbidden when we think about copyright. I think either side of that dichotomy is a mistake. I think what the framers thought, and the framing generation, if you look at the contemporaneous discourse about copyright, the use of property to refer to copyright goes all the way back to the early period of the Statute of Anne. The term literary property, it gets used throughout the 1700s. It was used by Madison himself, even though there are some places where he talks about copyright under the rubric of monopoly. There are other places where he talks about it as a form of property. He himself submitted a copyright statute to the Virginia legislature that talked about literary property. So I don't think that, I think we have to be a little bit more nuanced in our thinking about this and try to understand how, for them, were these two things reconciled. And I think the way we do that is by recognizing it is property to the extent that there is a legitimate moral claim of the type, the same type that underlies other property rights. That doesn't lead us to say that property right, that copyright has to be perpetual or absolute. In fact, no property rights are absolute. Even ones in land are not absolute. Nor, in fact, are any property rights really perpetual. Because you can have things like adverse possession. And here's a place where it's crucial, I think, to make the distinction that copyright was regarded as a valid property right, provided that it remained limited in time. And Madison is very clear on this. He said it's a monopoly, but it's a monopoly that is, you know, to which there's no just objection as long as it's property limited. And the one place that I think I agree most with Tom is that we need Congress to be much more circumspect in thinking about what its the proper limits on its power should be under the limited times provision. Now, it's difficult to draw justiciable lines there for reasons we can discuss later, but I do think that Congress has been probably derelict in its duty, you know, its duty to apply its oath to uphold the Constitution in really taking seriously the question of what sorts of lines should we draw to make sure that copyright does not become perpetual on the installment plan. I think that is a serious issue, and that does threaten to undermine copyright. I'll also take issue a little bit with one of the claims that Tom made, which is that the framers thought copyright was only about serious nonfiction works, and it didn't include music and poems and things. If you look at the list of works that were actually registered under the first Copyright Act from 1790 to 1800, you'll find plenty of music. In fact, the English courts had held that music fit inside the category of books. Books didn't mean literary works necessarily. It meant stuff that you could publish and print in book form. And in fact, you'll find lots of examples of songs, songbooks, musical comedies, operas, in the list of copyrighted works that were registered federally in the first 10 years, poems, novels. So I think it's difficult to draw any sort of a robust line on subject matter with regard to whether it's serious or nonfiction or entertaining. I think people who have tried find it very difficult to draw the line between entertainment and learning, even though we can all point to examples of things that we would have a hard time regarding as terribly edifying, and I would agree. I do think it's somewhat perverse that we now give, in effect, more robust protection to works of pure fiction than we do to works of, factual or nonfiction content. And in fact, that's one respect in which going back to a framer's understanding probably means we should actually expand copyright in one extent, because the framers, as Tom pointed out, the first thing that they mentioned was maps. And maps are nothing but compilations of facts about the material world. And our current copyright doctrine, you know, we've decided since Feist that, you know, compilations of facts have to get incredibly thin protection. It's not clear that the framers believed that. For the first, you know, long period of our copyright history, factual compilations got more robust protection than they do now. So that's one respect in which going back to the framers' understanding might actually increase the scope of protection granted to a certain category of works. I'm going to stop now so we can actually have a discussion and talk about what the listeners want to talk about. But thanks for listening.
Thank you, Professor Newman. Before we do that, let me go back to Professor Bell and see if he wants to take a minute or two to respond.
As usual, I have to agree with Chris's factual statements. He's very well informed. One thing I'll add, as long as we're bringing up music, is that, as Chris noted, those works, the operas, the books of poems, the books of music, were published and protected as books. Note that the 1790 Copyright Act, unlike today's Copyright Act, afforded no rights against the public performance of restricted works. So in the founders' era, you could, of course, get busted for making copies of a book of songs, although I will note that my authorities on this, and my authority is William Patry, a noted scholar of copyright, say that, in fact, almost all the works were practical. There were some books of poetry and songs, but most things were, manuals, textbooks, works of instructions, geographical atlases, commercial directories. That was the bulk of registrations. At any rate, there were some artsy things in there, but the protections granted did not go towards performance. So you could grab one of these pirated books and do a performance and be totally in the clear under the 1790 Copyright Act. That, of course, is not true today. And this is to say nothing of derivative works. In the founders' era, if you wanted to do a translation of a book, make a copy of it, no problem. Today, you'd be busted and big time.
All right, let's go to the audience to see about their questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our first caller, let me make an announcement about some upcoming calls we have later this week. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number, we'll be talking about the new book, Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the president's LGBT executive order. And then Thursday at 2 p.m., we'll have a litigation update on the Fisher affirmative action case heard by the Supreme Court and remanded for further proceedings below. That's Thursday at 2 p.m. Today, of course, copyright originalism. We've got four callers with questions pending, so let's take that first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I think this is a case where textualism doesn't quite do the job, because the text simply says for limited times, but one really has to look into the legislative history of that text in order to understand what the framers meant by limited. And from all the evidence we have, it really meant limited to the period of time necessary to obtain a positive return on investment. And it was thought that 14 years was sufficient to do that. The possible extension if there was some delay in publication or other use of the copyrighted material. So even the extension to a second term of 14 years was contingent on not having realized the profit during the first 14 years. But unless you examine the, you might say, legislative history of the text, you're not going to be able to obtain a solid basis for deciding how long it should be. And of course, today we have a situation where the courts allow Congress to say something like, well, we'll make the copyright valid for 1 billion years, and well, it's a limited time, so it's not unconstitutional. But on another point, there's a problem of orphan works, because originally the copyright process provided for a way of registering copyright in a way it does not today. But today, for those works that have no apparent owner, and there is in a period of time when it might have been extended but may not have been, you create a limbo area, particularly in the middle of the 20th century, when there are a lot of important scholarly works that really should be digitally reproduced and distributed, and yet no one can find anyone to get permission from. And something needs
Who wants to respond?
I can say something about both things. Shall I take the first question first, and then Chris, and then the second question, Chris?
Go ahead, Tom. You can answer both, and then if I have anything to add, I can chime in.
Okay. So this is Professor Bell. Thank you for your questions. Let me go to the first one first about the term. I agree that the plain language of the statute doesn't provide us much guidance. I said statute. I should say the Constitution, better yet. It simply says limited times. And I agree, as you've asserted, that really economic theory suggests the term should last no longer than to allow the holder of the copyright to recoup their fixed costs. That's what standard economic models of copyright demonstrate. And I have all the details you could want in my book. So having said that, I agree with all that. Let's also admit that for public choice reasons, we're going to get very long terms. And on this point, I have to slight Madison. And it's true, as Chris noted, Madison made a plea for copyright in the Federalist Papers. What most people don't know is that he backed off of his views, or at least showed a more nuanced view of copyright in his correspondence with Thomas Jefferson. Because Jefferson, writing from Paris, he was very far from the ratification debates, but he caught this bit about copyright, and Jefferson wrote to Madison saying, basically, is that really such a good idea, my friend? And Madison wrote back, and it's a long quote, and it's hard to excerpt, but I think it reveals Madison actually had more doubts than his, let's admit, his pamphleteering in the Federalist Papers would have suggested. In the Federalist Papers, he was being an advocate. With Jefferson, he kind of let down his guard and said, well, you're right, Tom, there's some issues here. And here is where Madison kind of screwed up, frankly. He's defending copyright to Jefferson. And here's what Madison, I'm going to quote his letter. Here's what Madison says. Now, when I read this, think about public choice theory and how Madison blows it. Here's Madison. Monopolies are sacrifices of the many to the few. Where the power is in the few, it is natural for them to sacrifice the many to their own partialities and corruptions. Where the power, as with us, is in the many, not in the few, the danger cannot be very great that the few will thus be favored. It is much more to be dreaded that the few will be unnecessarily sacrificed to the many. Okay, students of public choice theory know that puts things exactly upside down. In fact, what public choice theory would predict and what experience has amply confirmed with regard to the copyright term and other areas is that the few who enjoy copyright have in practice a lot more power to determine the scope of their privileges than do all of us who don't have as much at stake. We don't really follow copyright debates. I mean, people like me and Chris do, but we're kind of copyright geeks. Your average voter doesn't care about the copyright term for good reason, because they're rational. And so that means the copyright term gets longer and longer and longer. Madison either didn't see that or wouldn't admit it in his correspondence with Jefferson, and that's why copyright has blown totally out of proportion. It's basically because special interests have seized control of the legislative process. And indeed, by the way, this goes back even to the 1790 Copyright Act. The first draft of the 1790 Copyright Act came not from a legislator, but from Daniel Webster, who happened to enjoy some of the widest printings of anybody else in the founding era. He was out there lobbying actively, both at the Constitutional Convention and in the First Congress, to get his works protected. So yay for him, not so clear it's good for the rest of us. As for orphan works, so that's my first comment. I agree with everything you said, and let's also take note of public choice. Your second question was about orphan works. I agree there. Orphan works are a serious problem. And we can blame the Berne Convention, and to be a little bit more prickly about it, dangerous ideas from Europe infiltrating the American legal system. That's what the Berne Convention did. The Berne Convention is an international convention on copyright. It has many virtues, but among its vices is this infection it picked up somewhere in Europe that basically accords authors not just natural rights, but even beyond that, in this European view of what's sometimes mistranslated as moral rights, a better translation would be authors' rights, authors actually have a piece of themselves in everything that they create. And so in France, for example, not only are you not allowed to do much by way of fair use, but if an author decides she wants to withdraw her book from the shelves because her views have changed, it doesn't reflect her personality, she has the power to go into bookstores and take her book off the shelves. She has to give compensation, but still, that's a remarkable power. It would never fly under our First Amendment, I hope. And we can blame Berne for bringing that idea into the United States, because the United States acceded to the Berne Convention in the 1980s. And as a consequence, we no longer can impose notice requirements on works of foreign authors. And the current Copyright Act basically says everything anybody fixes in a tangible medium is protected under copyright, even if they don't stamp it with a copyright notice. And that's why we have orphan works, because no longer is it enough to look over a document or a film or a piece of music and say, oh, there's no copyright notice, I guess it's in the public domain. You can't assume that anymore. You have to assume everything is restricted. You can blame Berne for that, and the consequence has been orphan works and other various sins, which I won't get to. I mean, that's bad enough.
Okay. So yeah, it's a good point about the limits of textualism with regard to limited times. I've read various people making arguments as to some ways in which we might try to put some flesh on those bones, because as I said before, I do think it's crucial, and for the public choice reasons that Tom rightly points to, and that I think the framers were aware of, it is necessary to have, I think, some way in which certainly legislators who have an oath to uphold the Constitution should be checking themselves to see whether they're being faithful. And, you know, ideally we'd like it to be justiciable so courts can police them. It is a difficult task, though. I, as a matter of, say, prophylactic construction, this is why I was relatively sympathetic to the rule that was being proposed in Eldred that would say no retroactive extensions of the term. It's hard to, you know, I think the court was wary of doing that because they would have had to distinguish a lot of history in order to come up with such a rule. That at least would have helped ameliorate the public choice pressures to expansion if you had a no retroactive expansion. There's other possible ways of thinking about it would be to say, Larry Sullum has suggested that one way of thinking about it would be to say, look, it's a right that's granted to an author for a limited time, which means that we should decide what would reasonably count as a limited time from the perspective of the author and his reading of that as well. It should be bounded by something less than an expected lifespan of an author. So in other words, we shouldn't be granting copyrights that last life plus. They should be for a fixed term of years, or at least the total amount that you can get ought to be a fixed term of years that's something less than a normal lifespan. Another way of thinking about, perhaps this might provide a good argument for saying that we're at the outer edge now, would be to say, look, you don't want to have copyright that lasts longer than the effective amount of control somebody can have over their land. And as we know, the amount of control you can have over your land is limited by the rule against perpetuities, which says if you're going to try to devise land and control what happens to it in the long term, you can only do that for as long as a life in being plus 21 years, as all one all property students love know to their chagrin. And that, you know, we're probably getting close to the outer limits of what one could possibly get, you know, through the statute, through the, you know, under the rule against perpetuities with regard to copyright, which might be a good argument for saying, look, if we get any longer than this, you're really taking copyright outside, you know, even the realm of what tangible property gets. So those are a couple ideas, I mean, as to how one might try to get some textual meaning. None of them are fully, you know, knocked down arguments that you can say with certainty, this is the original meaning. It's a difficult problem, but certainly there are things that legislature should keep in mind. Orphan works, I agree with Tom, and this is a problem. It's an important problem, and I agree that the formalities is the doing away with formalities is the culprit. Here's an example of a place where I would suggest that thinking about copyright through a property paradigm might actually suggest a good solution, because in the realm of, you know, we have a similar problem in real property, which is if you're letting your land lie fallow and nobody's there and nobody's tending it, adverse possession is a possibility. And it seems to me that that principle, exactly how you implement it in copyright is tricky, because obviously it's more difficult for a copyright owner to know what's being done with his work than, you know, we assume that a property owner, if he wants to control land, has a duty, in effect, to keep tabs on it, otherwise he stands to lose it through adverse possession. You could have a rule, for example, that deals with orphan works by saying, look, if you're a copyright owner, you have a duty to check with the copyright office every once in a while, and if you're somebody who wants to use a work that, as far as you can tell, seems to be abandoned, you file a claim with the copyright office saying, look, I'm going to start making use of this, I've tried to find the author, I can't find them, I'm going to start using it, and you give notice to the copyright office, and if the copyright owner doesn't show up and contest that within X amount of time, they lose the right. I mean, that would be perfectly consistent with property as with copyright as a piece of property, and I think it's a good solution to the problem.
Let's take another call.
Hi, Jake Linford at Florida State University. I'm kind of curious about possible solutions here. I mean, let's assume for a minute, Tom's exactly right, that we need something to look different. Now, one option is to wait for Congress to fix this problem. I mean, my perception from where I sit is Congress is a little bit dysfunctional. Is there any hope of kind of inserting the courts and giving them the majority in both Golan and Eldred wanted to take a fairly hands-off approach. In light of the public choice problems you were just talking about, is that the right approach? Or is there room for courts to be a little more robust in thinking about proper constitutional limits to IP protection?
This is Tom Bell. I'll take a stab at that and hand it over to Chris. It's a great question. I agree that lobbying lawmakers will not go very far. I'm all for that. I just don't think it's going to get very far with copyright. I was on the Hill this spring, though, and I will say that the beating they took lawmakers did under the SOPA-PIPA Act, you might recall that was when they proposed a law and then Wikipedia, among others, kind of protested with these blacked out pages, and wow, that got a lot of attention. That woke up a lot of lawmakers. Still, I don't think we can count on that. So let's set aside lobbying. What else can you do? Well, I talk about some solutions in my book that are kind of detailed. I don't think I want to get into them here, but I will say it's a very, very hard problem, in part because of these public choice problems. And the solution has to be, if you go through the legislative process, kind of very subtle. I actually advocate what I call legal jujitsu. I won't describe the techniques here. I'll just say that, you know, that's an area that is very tricky. And just two more things I'll say, that one that lawmakers could do that actually might work, and one that courts might do. One is changing the Copyright Act so that formalities apply to U.S. residents and citizens. There's no reason, Byrne only says you can't impose formalities on foreign authors. So the United States could say, you know, we like formalities, actually. We're bound by Byrne. We're not going to walk away from that convention. I think we should actually consider it, but that's a no-starter. We're going to impose formalities on Americans, and that would be okay with Byrne. Query where the lawmakers would do it. What can courts do? Well, I'm not actually that happy with having courts patch up these problems, although I recognize it may be more practical than expecting to make it through the thicket of lobbyists surrounding the act. But I will say I think courts could do more with the copyright misuse doctrine. I talk about that more in my book. It was borrowed from patent law. It's basically a court-invented doctrine. Courts have been slowly bringing it into copyright, and I think it has some promise to make things better there. And I'll just stop with that. You know, there's a few ideas. None of them are knocked down. There's the solution. Hard problems do not admit easy solutions, and this is a hard problem.
Yeah, this is Chris Newman. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I'm somewhat sanguine along the grounds that, you know, what Tom alluded to earlier, and that I think we have probably come close to the high water mark of copyright overreaching, to the extent that there's been overreaching, because what it has become a much more salient public issue, and there are lots of other lobbyists on the other side. Now, those lobbyists are only after their own interests, just like the copyright owners are after theirs, so they're not necessarily all policing every issue for optimal copyright law, so that's not necessarily a cure-all. But I think, as Tom pointed out, I think you know, frankly, I think Eldred was sort of a Pyrrhic victory for copyright owners, because in effect, what it did was galvanize a public backlash against copyright overreaching. And I think, and when I talk to copyright owners, I get to some extent, at least some of the, you know, people who work in the big industries, that I think on a certain level they get this, that they realize that in an internet world, their main concern is maintaining enough public support for protecting them from wholesale digital piracy, and that the time to be trying to overreach on, you know, scope or duration, that's not a good move right now. We'll have to see if that gets borne out in practice. I'm hopeful that, and so that's why, to some extent, I find myself wanting to push back against some of the anti-copyright rhetoric that's out there now, because I understand where it came from, but I think now it perhaps runs the risk of going the other way and undermining even, you know, legitimate requests by copyright owners to say, hey, look, my entire ability to profit from this work is being destroyed by online piracy. So, in terms of what can courts do, I mean, there are a lot of copyright doctrine is created by courts. So, for example, to the extent that copyright has gotten overly broad in terms of derivative works, which is something that Tom mentioned earlier, and I've written about this, I do think that, and this is a place where you can bring the Constitution and originalism back in to some extent, because the Constitution gives exclusive rights to writings. And there are certain places in copyright doctrine where we've gotten a little bit overly broad, I think. For example, in regarding a fictional character as a quasi-copyrightable work in its own right, apart from the original fixed work, the writing in which it appeared. There are various areas in which I think I've argued for a more strict interpretation of what the scope of the protected property interest, the work, the writing is, and how that might lead us to dial back a little bit the scope of derivative rights, and that would do a lot of help. It would mean fair use would have to do less work. So that's one idea I have in that regard, and I'll end here so somebody else can ask something.
If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple questions pending. Let me ask you, Professor Bell, are you explicitly arguing that life plus 70 years is constitutionally infirm, or is it just as a policy matter just unwise?
I don't think I can make that argument constitutionally. The Constitution is written very broadly. It's still a limited term. I think it was Chris used a phrase like, you know, could they say life the author plus a million years? They could, in theory. There's other things to complain about, but unconstitutionality, no.
Okay. All right. Let's take another caller question.
Good afternoon. My question is directed to Professor Bell, but Professor Newman, I'm sure, has some thoughts on this too. As a preparatory note, I'm very fond of the founders and their thinking, but I'm curious over the split you made, Professor Bell, on the natural rights issue that you perceive the other camp has in this matter. You made note of how the founders did not have a natural right to use copyrights, and then you also state proudly that you're sticking to what they did in 1790. I'm curious what the principles are that underline the justification of sticking with a 1790 approach if there isn't a superior moral interest going along with that. So, for instance, why shouldn't software be covered per se as a copyright? And you also noted that public performances were not covered originally, but if Congress later discovers it to be useful and we're not thinking about the morality of property rights, why shouldn't Congress expand that right in that way?
All right, thank you. I look forward to Chris's answer to this too, but I'll take a stab at it. Well, when I say that copyright shouldn't be regarded as a natural right, I'm not saying it should have no standing in the law. Let's be clear about that. I reserve natural rights to a very discrete, a very special class of rights. And different people have different justifications of natural rights. The one rolled out most often, at least among friends of property, libertarians and conservatives, is Lockean theory. And I will admit, I'm not a huge fan of Lockean theory. I think it has some salient flaws, but out of respect for my fellow travelers, I want to give it a fair shake. And let me just observe that Richard Epstein and I, who have debated copyright, we disagree about a lot, but we both agree that Lockean theory does not really do a very good job of justifying copyright. The problems are manifold, but one problem is, for example, that Locke's theory does not take into account the non-rivalrous nature of copyrighted works. It makes for a very fundamental difference between tangible property and so-called intellectual properties like copyright. And this is one place where I would make a plea to my fellow travelers to, look, respect the past, right? I'm the guy saying reenact the founder's copyright. Respect the past. Those were great thinkers. But don't be afraid to update your thinking with economic theories that they did not have at hand. Economic thinking has developed since the era of the founders. They had an inkling of what non-rivalry and consumption meant. In fact, Jefferson has a wonderful passage he wrote to someone comparing ideas to, well, he said a lighted taper, he meant a candle. An idea is like a lighted candle, and you can light someone else's candle with your candle, and they can do likewise, and you can illuminate the world. And Jefferson made that as an argument against a natural right in ideas. So the same argument extends to copyrights. So natural rights, different theories. Lockean theory, I think, is actually does not fit copyright very well, although it's rolled out very frequently. And there are other theories of natural rights, which I'm actually more agreeable with, but I'll leave that to the book. Read the book, Intellectual Privilege. I talk about what I think is a better approach to natural rights and why copyright doesn't fit. And before I hand it over to Chris, let me say I agree with Chris. He raised this, I think, as a cautionary note, and I want to say I hear him and agree with him, that just because you say it's not a natural right, also I say copyright is not a common law right, does not mean, you know, anything goes. There are plenty of privileges out there that I think are worth respecting, but copyrights and patents among them. To the extent that they do good work, and at some margin they do, let's respect them. And furthermore, you know, lawmakers have pretty much, you know, they've crossed off the boxes, they dotted their I's and crossed their T's when they pass these laws, and that deserves at least a presumption of respect. I'm not calling for anarchy here. I'm calling for skepticism and reform. But in the meantime, I got to tell you, I'm actually quite strict about copyright.
Professor Newman, you want to break in here?
Well, it's interesting. I think the caller asked an interesting question, because I think the way he framed it was, if you're going to say that copyright is purely a question of industrial regulation, why should we particularly care what they thought the state of that was in 1790? Because if times have changed, then we should just, you know, regulate differently. If the methods of production are different, the types of works that are salient and the ways in which they're reproduced are different, then there's no particular reason we should care what happened then. I think that's a valid point. I'm not sure that, to the extent that we're here today talking about originalism in the sense of constitutional originalism, I'm not sure it changes anything, because you would still, even if you, you know, if you take a regulatory view of copyright, you still have to limit it to the extent that you can to the phrases that are used in the Constitution. Well, I'll just take a quick rejoinder to what Tom was saying about natural rights. I am very sympathetic to a Lockean type of argument, and I think that it does justify intellectual property rights, property limited. Locke himself thought that life plus 70 was the right term for copyright, and he said as much. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, Locke's not God. It doesn't mean that he's right, but I think his argument, and I think more generally, to the extent that you think property embodies not just an economic policy, but some sort of normative moral principle. If you believe that, for any property, I think you have to be very careful about deciding that it doesn't apply to intellectual property as well, because I think, you know, there's a lot of people out there who want to treat all property the way that Tom wants to treat intellectual property. Yeah, it's the sort of thing that, you know, we should grant to the extent that we think it furthers the collective good, but anything beyond that, you have no complaint if we decide not to do it. And I think there's good reasons to say, look, if the underlying, to the extent that you believe one of the underlying moral principle of property is that we should not use, we should not interfere with people's ability to profit from their own labor, to create things of value that they can offer for offer to others as the basis for an exchange of value for value, this idea that that's the basis on which, you know, a free enterprise system and a division of labor that renders society a positive sum game is based on that, then it's true that intellectual property presents problems of line drawing, as we've already seen, that are different from those that get raised with tangible goods, somewhat more difficult, though tangible goods is not as easy as it's often made out to be. But the underlying moral principle, I think, is very similar. It's the same, because if somebody makes it impossible for you to profit from devoting your life to a particular intellectual endeavor, then it's just as though you had spent your life, you know, tilling a field and somebody's come along and burned or taken or consumed your wheat. It doesn't enable you to make a living. So I would say that there's an important moral underpinning there. I agree that it has to be worked out differently and that it shouldn't be used for overreaching goals. My goal in my scholarship is to try to figure out what are the right property limited analogies, which don't use property as a rhetorical move to try to get unlimited copyright, but take property seriously as a mechanism and say, okay, what are the limits, the principled limits that have to be on property of any type, whether it's intangible or intellectual, and how do you keep it consistent? All right, I'll stop at that.
Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. The book we've been talking about has been mentioned a few times. There is a link to it in the notice you got of today's Teleforum conference call. Its title is Intellectual Privilege, Copyright, Common Law, and the Common Good, and the author is Tom Bell joining us here today. At this point, we've got two questions pending, so let's see if we can take another question from our audience.
Marianne McGrail, an attorney in D.C. You answered my original question, which had to do with any correspondence related to Article 1, Section 8. I have another question for both speakers. Your view of Justice Story's impact on the development of American copyright law.
I'm sorry, I didn't. Maybe Chris would want to take a stab at it. I didn't quite hear. You're wondering about the development. I'm sorry, can you repeat it?
The impact of Justice Story?
Yes. Have I got that name right?
Yeah, that is an important name. Go ahead. Did you want to answer that, Tom?
His
I need more context.
Are you talking about, I mean, Justice Story is the author of Folsom v. Marsh, which is regarded as the first fair use case. Is that what you're referring to?
Right. And my question is, you had alluded to the fact that jurisprudence has had a strong impact on the development of copyright law in the United States. And it strikes me that Justice Story had a very profound influence on that development. Do you agree with that?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and I can't say that I have focused specifically on Justice Story and his impact to give a good answer to it. Do you have something about that, Tom?
No, I'm afraid I'm in the same camp. It sounds like an interesting claim, and I'm sure there's a lot to back it up, but I'd have to bone up on Justice Story's opinions, which are long out of date now, before I could really answer that in an informed way. I'm sorry.
Maybe if I just ask you about the impact of the development of the concept of fair use on copyright law. Do you consider that an important development in copyright law?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think there we can thank the First Amendment for stepping in and saving us from the worst of copyright abuses. Although it did develop first in England, there's that. Let me say this, though. I've gone on record on saying that I wouldn't say I'm not a fan of fair use. I am, but that I, unlike a lot of commentators, do not regret the fact that the scope of fair use in some sense is shrinking. And why is that happening? Well, let's think about music. I mean, there was a time when fair use in music was a very big deal. If you wanted to make a mixtape for your friend, you know, you had to make copies of songs, and then questions arose. Well, can I make a kind of a low fidelity copy off of my LP on my cassette for my friend? It's a personal, non-commercial use. And you end up dragged into these fair use debates. You don't have to do that anymore. Why? Because you can buy the music so easily through iTunes. So markets solve fair use problems. I do agree with Wendy Gordon. We disagree about other things, but she's a copyright scholar who has argued that fair use, the best way to understand it is it's a response to market failure. When markets can't get the job done, one of the things I best like about copyrights, one of their best property-like features, is that markets can be brought to bear in allocating rights to copyrighted works. And I say, more of that, please. I want there to be less argument about fair use, because when people want something, they can go buy access to it, get the clearance at a low price, very simply. That's what iTunes does. It's a wonder. It's a blessing.
Hear, hear. I agree with Tom on wholeheartedly on the last sentiment he expressed. And I'll just say, I think, yeah, fair use is, again, you know, fair use is a doctrine that I think is to some extent overburdened, because we have allowed our ideas to what constitutes infringement to get overly broad. It's as though you had the doctrine of trespass said, well, you're not only trespassing if you step on somebody's property, but if you stand 5 yards away and look over the fence or something. And so I think what fair use does to a large extent is help us identify two categories of uses that really should not be regarded as violations of property rights. One is what I'll call non-conflicting use, which would be uses that, even though they nominally fall within the scope of the exclusive rights, are ones that really do not threaten the copyright owner's legitimate interests in use of their work. The other would be what I call privileged uses, which is uses that, even though perhaps to some extent they do entrench on the copyright owner's legitimate interests, they're ones where we think there is an overriding interest in the user or in the public benefit from that category of use to allow it anyway. And again, there are analogies to both of those doctrines in regular traditional property law. So I view fair use is just a doctrine that works out very similar problems in this analogous realm. But yes, it's a very important integral part of copyright doctrine.
All right, we've got still two questions pending. We've got about 8 minutes left, so I'm going to ask the callers to be as concise as possible with their questions. Hopefully we can get to both questions.
John Rowland, Constitution.org again. Perhaps it would be useful to examine the concept of vested property rights, because the Lockean notion of property rights really presumes that a property has vested in the claimed owner, and the protection is for that settled property thereafter. But that still leaves open the question of the distributive questions of who owns how much of what, until the issues are settled. And that very much affects something like copyright, because the question of who owns how much of what and for what purposes may indeed not be vested. And it's also, I also add a side note here that when Locke wrote, he wrote about things like appropriation of unused property, in other words, land. And that was not unknown in England at the time, but what he seems to have mainly had in mind was the frontier, America, the New World, in which people could appropriate land, mingle their labor with it, and become owners of that land. And, of course, we know he was the author of one of the first constitutions, the Constitutions of Carolina, which is now North and South Carolina, and Georgia, which was not adopted, but it was certainly given consideration. And so he was very much looking toward the New World frontier in the way he wrote what he wrote.
Well, this is Professor Bell. I don't hear a question, but I'll just say I agree that a problem in applying Locke's theory to copyright is that Locke talks about appropriating unowned things. And despite their claims of genius, very few copyright holders really come up with something new. They borrow from other stuff. So really, if we want to do Lockean theory on copyright, we should talk not about walking through a wilderness, but something more like walking through a supermarket and picking up things. And, you know, it's hard to determine. Sure, copyright owners add new things. Maybe it's like walking through a hardware store, and you pick up things owned by other people, and you put them together in a new way. Well, yay, you did something new. You know, now there's a great new way to clean floors. But you borrowed. So people who just apply Lockean theory, reading his works about walking through the wilderness and picking up acorns, are missing a big element. And that's one reason I don't think Lockean theory works great. Not in this area.
No, of course, I think we're true of the tangible world, because when you walk around and pick up acorns, the acorns are already there. Nevertheless, what you've done by picking them up and gathering them is rendering them more useful to human flourishing. And so I think the similar thing can be said about, even if you're taking pre-existing cultural elements and rearranging them or using them in a new way, you can be adding something that's valuable. And copyright doctrine is very careful to try to distinguish between what you took that was pre-existing and you can't claim, and the actual trying to limit the scope of what you can actually claim as something that you added. And that can be done better, but certainly copyright doctrine tries to draw that line.
Let's take a final question here. Go ahead, caller. You might have your telephone on mute.
Hi, Lee Dunn with Google. Not working my phone well. I think my question was partially answered in the discussion of fair use, and I like the way that the professors put fair use in two different categories and how they looked at it. And I guess I'd then maybe ask a follow-up question, which is that Google here, we cite fair use for showing snippets of websites to give the user the choice of what websites to go click on through a search engine. Do you believe that this use of fair use is one that will allow more innovation in the future, or how do you see this view of fair use being played out with new technologies?
Thanks for your question. I'll answer quickly and let Chris answer, because he came up with that, which I like also, that dichotomous view of fair use. I'd say, yes, that sounds to me like a fair use under current conditions. But if a market arose, maybe someone should look into this, where Google could pretty easily pay a small licensing fee, because Google makes money off of, you know, showing people these images. If they could pretty easily, like with iTunes, pay people just for showing a clip, a video clip, to let their customers choose, I would say, to the extent that market existed, the scope of fair use should, and I think probably would, shrink. And I think everyone should celebrate that. Well, maybe not Google shareholders, but almost everyone else should celebrate that.
One thing I'll say, adding on to Tom, is that I'm not as sanguine as he is that the law would actually move in that direction. Because if you think about it, the Sony Betamax case is currently read as just holding categorically as a matter of law that time shifting is fair use. And I think under Tom's reasoning, what we should be saying is, hey, now that you can get any TV show you want on demand, you know, for that, now that the market provides that, there's no longer any necessary fair use justification for people making their own copies in order to watch them when they want. It's not clear to me that once things get enshrined as fair use, then a normative sense of entitlement to that use tends to be cultivated, and I think it's very difficult to go back. So I'm not sure that fair use will evolve in the way that Tom says it should, though I might agree with him. I'm actually not sure that I do agree with him. This might be a case where I actually think that I might argue, based on a property paradigm, that fair use, in fact, that a snippet, because a snippet, I would say, is not a use of the work, it's only a use of a small part of the work, that's actually not one of the things that even under a Lockean theory we should give the copyright owner exclusive rights to. So I guess I'm more sympathetic to the fair use claim in its current incarnation than Tom.
Oh, you know, I like that too, Chris. You know, I think you could convince me on that one.
Well, this is Dean Reuter once again. I want to thank Professors Tom Bell and Chris Newman for their enlightening remarks here today. I also want to thank our audience for joining us and for your questions and participation. A reminder to our audience that our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow at 1 p.m. We'll be talking about another book, Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.